Ashish is going to speak about, well, his title of the paper is Revisiting a View from the Tea Shop. Is that right?
Yeah.
To a great extent, I hope that what I'm now going to say would constitute something like a footnote to Geeta's much larger formulations, because I think I'm trying to get at many of the same questions that she asked this morning, but in a very different way. Possibly, I might add, given the nature of the audience and many friends in it, in a somewhat mischievous way, something I've never done before. I'm going to hinge my entire argument on a Bhupen Khakkar painting, one single painting, a painting that many of you know probably very much better than I, and I cannot forget that the artist is himself in the room. And I'm going to actually ask a whole range of questions which I think are relevant to the debate, many of which Geeta asked in a different and a more general manner, by asking you this one question, actually, and worrying our way through this one question of whose view is it? Who is looking? It's called A View from the Tea Shop. Is it the view of the chaiwala? Is it the view of the common man, the sort of, you know, many people around in the background who come along and presumably drink tea? Whose view is it? This is actually the question I'm going to ask, and I'm going to, in a sense, walk you through three readings of this particular painting. The first is basically hinged on the fact that on a certain set of debates, actually, that took place at the time the painting was made. This particular painting, A View from the Tea Shop, was done in 1974, and we're going to discover subsequently that that particular year was quite important. Shortly thereafter, Geeta Kapoor titled her chapter on Bhupen in her book Contemporary Indian Artists with the title A View from the Tea Shop. And in that essay on Bhupen, she actually made a series of formulations on Bhupen, which in many ways have remained definitive. In many ways, Bhupen Khakkar continues to be seen in those terms, and to a great extent, this particular debate and the manner in which she mobilized Bhupen for it was crucial to her, at that point of time, designation of a contemporary as opposed to a modern Indian art. I've never, and Geeta could enlighten me on this, I've never figured out who, in fact, started using the word contemporary. I suspect maybe Geeta herself. But clearly, the space occupied by a contemporary is different from the narrowed and more specifically sort of modernist agendas of post-independence Indian art. And in this particular case, it includes the vastly more contentious space of an urban painting, of an urban art and urban mass culture. Geeta Kapoor in 1978 presented Bhupen in certain ways. She said, Bhupen is entirely on the side of the common man. The ordinary man that he paints would be too embarrassed to stand proxy for some existential idea. He exists, nevertheless, making up the environment of those of us who are prone to philosophize, yet hardly escaping the tastes and values and condition of our next-door neighbor. The retired old man with his useless desires, or the householder who plies a petty trade and enjoys cheap films, or the disgruntled worker, Bhupen, she says, brings the man into focus and puts a spoke into the act of philosophizing. This is his kind of realism. Speaking more specifically about this particular painting, she argues that his subject matter is deliberately banal. It provides a view from the tea shop, the wayside tea shop in a small town with its derelict clientele, and goes on to argue that Bhupen Khakkar as an artist identifies with, this is a crucial term I'm going to kind of return to again, identifies with not only the inelegance of the character's portrait, but also with what any sophisticate will call the sheer ugliness of their taste. By this conscious, deliberate identification, he introduces an irony that is without disgust or pity. I'm sure you can all recognize in this a certain kind of manner in which Bhupen Khakkar has, in a sense, been designated in public terms. Having, in a sense, identified or sort of named a specific voluntarist act of identification on Bhupen Khakkar's part, Geeta Kapoor at that point in time went on, and I think it was important for the discourses of the time, to map this particular identification onto a class divide between, on the one side, and I'm using the terms she used at that point, the elite, the bourgeoisie, represented at that point by art lovers, art galleries, and a class that imposes a culture of distinction, and for whom, basically, vulgarity is abhorrent, with, on the other side, and I'm quote, the common man of the Indian city who has no claims to culture. This view, as it were, from the tea shop, is an indication of the latter. It belongs to the common man, and in this particular instance, at that point of time, some of this terminology of the common man was interchangeable with another terminology of the middle class. This is, in a sense, a formulation that was made in 1978. And now I invite you to a second look at the painting. Presented, as it were, in the top half and through to the left is what we might call a panoramic view of a neighborhood, presumably a neighborhood of a small town, and, you know, something that sort of more or less stands for itself. And you're all familiar with Bupin's style of the time. But right now, let us contrast the particular panorama on the back and on the side with the tea stall itself. Although presented as a stall, would it be wrong to see it as one might a miniature stage set of an entire room with a window, a little wall painting, and the various paraphernalia of tea making strewn on the floor? If our viewer, the viewer whose view from the tea shop in a sense is designated, might be in a sense therefore presented in the painting itself, then it is possible to argue that this person would probably be sitting inside that room, and therefore the background would be a kind of a stage backdrop that would in some sense produce the environment, the framing context for the transaction that would take place in that space. And therefore, in other words, like the man cycling on the street. Wondering if the man had come here. In other words, like the man cycling on the street and the other people in the particular painting, the viewer, who is in a sense within the painting, is provided with something like a panoramic view of the city around the tea shop as something like a cultural enveloping rather than a specific view that's actually being made available to somebody within the painting for being looked at. I would point out that this view, which is as it were the internal view, the view of some hypothetical viewer within the painting, we might call a diegetic insider's view. And it is one that forces on us who are looking at the painting a compulsive tendency to narrativize. And this is actually the view to which Geeta Kapoor refers as the view from the tea shop, and which also in some sense featured so prominently in the particular people from particular situations kind of formulation of the place for people. But let us now look at the painting in a second view, a quite different one, which is specifically as a painting that's made available to us for to being looked at. The panoramic view in this sense, you know, as we look at it as a painting, is now presented to us, that is to say to Khakkar's audience, in what we might call its symbolic fullness. There is, in point of fact, no specifically designated diegetic viewer in the painting, and this you can see for yourself. And in his or her absence, what surfaces is something quite different from the narrative process. Earlier I said there was a kind of a compulsion to narrativize. Now what we have is a compulsion to denarrativize and to emphasize simultaneity across time. And in this sense, I'm using the word as Benedict Anderson uses it, as something that is transverse, cross time, marked not by prefiguring and fulfillment, but by temporal coincidence. And therefore, you know, different people are doing different things autonomously, but all brought together within a certain kind of space. That space being made available to us. And in that process, as a neighborhood, it becomes a unit along with family, community, patriarchy, and so on, that eventually becomes a unit of the state, you know, in its larger kind of context. And this is how we would look at it as a painting. And, you know, I'm suggesting, therefore, that it becomes one unit out of the many forms that provided the technical means for representing the kind of imagined community that eventually becomes the nation, quoting from Benedict Anderson. I've now suggested that there are two views. One is an internal viewer of somebody within the painting. The other is us looking at the painting. The first, a narrative act. The second, a kind of a denarrativizing act. And now I want to extrapolate further by in a sense, mapping this two-viewer theory onto Geeta Kapoor's class divide. Now, it is a well-known formulation that if indeed it is the elite who is looking at the painting, and Geeta at that point in time thought it was necessary to make that argument, then that elite has to play certain roles. I mean, it has to do certain things in order to be the elite. It has to, in the first place, designate certain what you might call workable ideologies. And part of that process of designation is literally of providing what you might call equivalence of, you know, the identity card that would posit potential groupings on the basis of collective memory or recognition, which then would be followed by a second move, which is the one in which people would then be invited to identify with this first designated entity. A quotation here. By responding to the call of the state to identify him or herself, The subject is interpellated or recruited by the symbolic. The definition of ideology as a representation of the imaginary relationship of subjects to their real conditions of existence suggests that ideology invokes a process of self-recognition by which the subject comes to acknowledge the truth or naturalness of its conditions of existence. It is therefore essential, therefore, for any elite, if it indeed constitutes the class that Geeta Kapoor at that point was trying to identify as one that provided a culture of distinction, that it intervene into I don't know what's going on. No, just shut it down. It was like that even before I died. It was like that already. I think Andreas Heusel is to blame. Back to the elite. It is essential, therefore, for any elite, if it has to do all of this which I've mentioned, that it, in a sense, intervene into the very procedures of knowledge which constantly symbolize new fragments of the real in order to annex them into reality. That, in other words, the elite constantly must annex, if you put it this way, different manifestations of the working imaginary in order to provide the workable symbolic, the symbolic of reality and its formal aesthetic counterpart, realism. Hence, is it for realism. Let me now present my first view, my first reading of the painting, which I suspect would not be uncommon at the time that the painting was made, although I don't know anyone who's actually presented this reading, which is that in identifying with the common man, which is what Geeta Kapoor is saying Bhupen Kakkar does by suggesting that this is the common man's view from the street, what Bhupen Kakkar is in fact doing is to identify the category of common man itself as constituting his designated subject, which then goes on, you know, into the process of, in the second view, inviting the audience to identify with the view of this common man. Although the first, you know, the identification of the common man is a more narrowly designative act, it is in fact the act that introduces or inaugurates the narrative to the extent that there is a narrative in this painting. It is the missing common man who fills out his space with little tales of different people doing different things that would only serve to establish the, in quotes, truth or naturalness of their conditions of existence. And the second view, which is the view of those of us who are looking at the painting, then constitutes an invitation to identify and identify with the view from the tea shop. In other words, narrative is now being annexed into a denarrativized process of manufacturing the view of the designating authority itself. In the realist narrative, I'm quoting here, the symbolic in its secularized contractual aspect is embodied in the citizen spectator whose interpretative authority brooks no challenge from the frame of representation, and since the painting is delivered up to such a spectator to look at, you know, and therefore identify it as a neighborhood, identify a certain common man whose view it in turn is, etc. This reading is obviously insufficient in itself, but it does actually serve my purpose in introducing the subject of realism here. It is possible, I think, to argue that realism constitutes in India and in most other uses of the term, basically as a means of creating a citizen subject, a means of creating a certain kind of hypothetical spectator. And that realism does not occupy the same terrain as the terrain of designating the contemporary. In fact, I think it is possible to speak of a great deal of 20th century art in India, and I'm thinking of Satyajit Ray's Apu trilogy, as actually being a chronicle of realism's struggle to arrive at the contemporary. I have an argument here which I won't go into about this. I'm going to now present to you a second view of the painting, which in a sense continues this realism argument, and this is in a sense a realist view of the painting. What would happen if this painting is viewed realistically? What would happen basically is that I think, A, you would be asked the question that regardless of what's going on inside the painting, what do you see before you? What is actually going on and how do you understand what you see before you? It is possible, therefore, to understand it quite easily. You see a neighborhood, you see a certain sort of a panoramic view of a city, a man shopping, a whole range of people doing different things, and in the front you have the tea shop itself, and a series of extrapolations that then follow. I think it is possible, for example, to continue this argument into the very many other ways in which this painting would have been clearly recognized by Pupenkaker's viewers at that time, the influence on Sienese painting, the influence on Sienese painting and of other sort of art historical references, as performing a certain kind, as therefore yoked to a certain kind of role of the artist, which in a sense these references then underscore. It is possible, I think, to argue that the art historical references then bring in some sense greater intelligibility to the formal task of introducing a workable indigenous realism. I think that a lot of other problems would then be solved as well. I think that, for example, the extent to which the tea shop dominates, the rest of the painting might have an explanation. It would be a certain kind of displacement of what would be an otherwise marginalization of certain perspectives, etc. And I want to suggest to you that Geeta Kapoor, in fact, in 1978 in her book, had provided this kind of an realist reading of an earlier Bhupenkaker painting called Factory Strike, where she had sort of suggested that the protagonist, the person who is on one side of the painting looking at us, is surrounded by a reality that he does not comprehend, but which is therefore, you know, the role of the artist to sort of present to us in its form, you know, as something that transcends the specific sort of comprehension of the act itself as understood that time. Clearly, if we were to sort of continue with this particular debate, this particular line of reading, as it were, we would privilege the actual viewer of the painting as being the one, as the actual viewer of the tea shop, as it were, as being the one who looks at the painting itself rather than the by now fast disappearing diegetic viewer. Now I want to go into this question of the spectator, you know, the realist spectator of this particular painting. And in doing this, I want to bring in a quite different debate, which is that at the time this particular painting was done, the early 70s, there was in fact an effort to create a new spectator who was going to be playing this kind of role, who was going to be in some sense playing the role of being the sort of authority for whom certain forms of reality would be presented with in certain modes. I'm referring, of course, in cinema to the formulation of a middle-class cinema, a cinema that was segmented, and in which a whole range of, in a sense, a whole range of moves were made by several people to initiate spectators into the protocols of receiving the invitation that would place their gaze as the dominant regulatory factor over the narrative. The gaze and its concomitant law of attention, which would then simulate a law of the state, or at least its mediation with the individual, would then follow. A certain tradition of realism, I think it's important to point out, was already in play by that point, and in film we're familiar with some of its consequences. It suggested a certain democratic realism, which said that the viewer did have certain kinds of choices. And in film, for example, we had this use of deep focus, as André Bazin presented it. But it was not something, and Madhav Prasad argues here, it's not something that can be construed directly as democratic choice for the realist spectator, but a potential choice given through the privilege of citizenship. The exercise of freedom does not jeopardize the process of meaning production, because nature, the law of attention, asserts itself. The artist, in this case Bhupenkaker, in order to respect that individual's freedom, or the newly formed individual in 1974, if you might call it that, that freedom must therefore curb his own freedom, must, in other words, merge his own identity into the invisible frame of such production of the symbolic. There is a long history to this, and I am not competent to present all of it to you, but the fact is that through the 20th century, through various kinds of independence movements and through various kinds of nationalisms, which in turn incarnated certain kinds of constitutional democratic rights for its own citizens, we also had a whole range of realisms which actually were the counterparts of this entire process of designating the citizen subject as possessing certain kinds of rights, and realism as the formal, in some sense, incarnation of these rights. From, you know, photorealism to magic realism to the many other kinds of realisms that we're all familiar with, these realisms played certain kinds of roles, which we're not, I think, always able to fully acknowledge in the Indian context. Very often they worked, by one argument, which I'm not going to go into my quotation details here, very often they worked through a certain kind of adaptation of this democratic realism principle that was quite often received from, or in a sense parented to Europe. An important convention that is quite often used, for example, by Latin American writers was of adapting realism, but through a somewhat perplexing suspension of what you might call the key narrative elements that would in a sense organize that reality, which would organize the knowledge that it presents and would in some sense kind of hierarchize that knowledge in certain given encoded ways that anybody who knows realism would be familiar with. The sudden kind of absence or disappearance of these key narrative devices, which at times have threatened to, in a sense, destabilize the entire realist project, as we've known it in a democratic sense, have led to many questions being asked as to what happens when this happens. I mean, what happens when certain key organizing logics disappear? The answer, and there's a piece by Madhav Prasad here, which he draws from an essay by Neil Larson, is that when a key narrative element which usually performs the role of an obvious rationalizing authority is withdrawn or seems to have disappeared, and in this case I'm talking about the disappearance of the internal viewer, the viewer whose view, the common man, is that when this kind of key narrativizing authority sort of disappears, then its effects are in all probability produced elsewhere. This is the important thing. Elsewhere on a vertical axis from a place outside and above the text. In the transition from the classic realist of the classic realist text, in the transition from the classic realist text of European literature to this realism of peripheral modernity, marked by a strategic suspension of rational mediation, the missing link is the figure of the citizen, which in its in-betweenness performs a double function of the state collective and the voice of narration, the present discursive agent of a self-absenting authority. The citizen, as the mediating figure between state and individual, is an elusive mechanism of social organization in conditions of underdevelopment. In other words, the suspension in the particular painting that you're seeing before us of any determining identifiable view that could be traced to a viewer protagonist, in the absence of this figure, the whole painting is forced into a different kind of space, a new precarious area where, in suspending this key element in the narration, that is, who is looking, which would, in a sense, organize the knowledge that we receive from the painting, and all the knowledge about the neighborhood and what its different people are doing and so on, Bhupen Kakkar is also, at this point of time, in 1974, locating the viewer in a somewhat uncharted, elusive space, while at the same time charging that viewer with as yet unspecified responsibilities. Unspecified precisely because the range of possibilities that are now opened up as the viewer is placed somewhere in between two extreme categories. Somewhere in between, on the one side, the absent and not quite common man, and on the other side, the hypothetical viewer citizen who has to now play a certain role in this, who has to play the mediating figure between state and individual. The viewer is provided with a way of looking that is at best somewhere, therefore, in between the simultaneity of several actions condensed into a frame and the responsibility of narrativizing all the action that takes place in the name of the absent common man or the absent diegetic viewer. I've gone into sort of several extremes of these sort of possibilities, which I won't go into, but I do want to suggest that this has been a somewhat anxiety-inducing problem. And I think maybe Nassim Ezekiel might have referred to that anxiety that if, in a sense, we are now new viewers who have, in a sense, been through certain kinds of epochs in post-nationalist India, then we have the authority to decide what's in front of us as being this or as being that. And if we're then told that we have not the education or we don't understand what's going on, then we resolve the problem in certain ways, which would be acknowledging a certain sort of either problem or a certain way of getting around that problem or whatever. In fact, Kumar Sahni in the late 80s, thank you, caught that particular anxiety well, where he was working on what he called the formal problematic of an artist who was, in conditions of outside of the rational, where suppression of certain key narrative elements, in fact, was essential. And he gave the example of Indian classical music, where harmony is actually suppressed in order to explore the melodic line. But he also then suggests what happens when this particular kind of suppression of key narrative elements happens in a sort of uncontrolled manner, when we face, to quote Kumar Sahni, a vacuum of emptiness that one may then fill up with projectiles of a passive subject and the morality of a system imposed through illusionistic means confusing the moral with natural law, the central equation being now that of private property. I'll do a little synopsis of the fact that this particular problem of the new viewer and how that particular viewer had to be now educated into the protocols and the responsibilities of viewing was a problem that was indeed addressed at that point of time in Baroda at the time or shortly after this particular painting was done. And its key theorist at that point was Ghulam Mohammad Sheikh, who in essays Mobile Vision and The Viewer's View had spoken of certain new protocols of viewing. You're all familiar with those writings, so I'll only sum them up briefly. He had spoken of illusionism rather than realism as being the problem and traced it to a specific history. And it was that he was trying to isolate rather than oil painting or realism, or indeed the contemporary. And he had said that the organizing element, the organizing sort of logic of illusionism was what he called the sort of tensions of a physical center, or the kind of weight of centrality obtained through juxtapositions of vanishing point in physical and pictorial centers crucial to the illusionistic visage. Sudhir Patwardhan made reference to this as well. And in opposition to this, or in contrast to this, what Shekhar suggested was, in a sense, and he gave the Ravenna mosaics as an example, the actual enactment of, in this case, an ambulating ritual that the viewer goes through even as he or she goes through the physical process of looking at a painting, the traveling eye, the traveling body, the process of reenactment. What he therefore sought to do, and what Bhupen Khakkar, it seems to me, seeks to do in this particular painting, was actually to evacuate the one key element of its hierarchizing organization of knowledge, which in this case was precisely the weight of that organizing centrality, but not so much a weight of a centrality as defined by a viewer who is within the tea shop, but actually the loss of the centrality itself. I think it is possible now to argue, and this is my second sort of proposition to you, that the real subject matter of a view from the tea shop is a loss of its gravitational centrality perceived precisely as a loss. I think it's only when we can actually recognize the visual fact of this loss that we can comprehend what this loss meant to Khakkar's designation of the middle class, because for now we would not talk about a class that is designated as his diegetic audience. We would not therefore start seeing the painting as being about a middle class. We would talk now about, in a sense, emphasizing or invoking Sheikh's emphasis on enactment, the visual economics of manufacturing an art that would open up a different sector to art practice itself in the context of this hypothetical middle class. There's plenty of evidence, in fact, in Geeta's writing of that time for Khakkar literally physically enacting that. I mean, he'd play this Congress MP and this guy who smokes a cigarette, the film star, and he'd have this biodata and all of that, which you are all familiar with. And she also suggested that Bhupen Khakkar actually makes a kind of a different kind of invitation to the illusory viewer to literally enter his painting, as opposed to being the common man for whom or for whose benefit mass culture is created, but who by that very logic is in some sense left out of it. In other words, we have in Khakkar's early invocation of the middle class a painting that is not part, that is now not in a sense a class that is designated as looking, but as the making of an art that is part of a larger paraphernalia of objects produced for and by the middle classes that quite literally enacts a symbolic order for its own imaginary constructions of itself. The middle class here is the class to which the state-created common man is now invited to identify, has to act out the need to keep remanufacturing itself into all that is around it. And in its assumed role of being, it sort of assumes this role at that point, the vehicle of change, and therefore in its negotiation of the complex relations between thought, culture, and power, in the words of Partha Chatterjee. In fact, Partha Chatterjee has listed what any class that is actually in this kind of a situation would have to do. Any class that is actually in a position of negotiating these different relationships between thought, culture, and change, thought, culture, and power, it would have to do many things. It would have to decide, for example, on the sites on which it would wish to engage with change. It would have to arrive at some understanding of what it wanted to assimilate, what it wanted to leave out, what the preconditions were for that assimilation. It would have to provide formulations for what existed before change occurred, and so on. Whereas here, what we're having is a secondarized space for enacting the discourse of somewhere else. This is actually typically, in some sense, now we are working out of realism. We're saying that realism, in some sense, constituted the the acting out of certain kinds of historical contradictions within a hegemonic structure of different kinds of realisms that, in a sense, were battling it out. And what Bhupen Khakkar did, and what, in a sense, melodrama, really, rather than realism, does, is to provide a secondarized space for the reenactment of these contradictions as melodrama understands them. To a great extent, there is a sort of a secondarized space that is literally instead of the primary one. Instead of the French ambassador, Bhupen Khakkar will call an unknown friend to inaugurate the show. Instead of holding a snazzy cocktail party to flatter the buyers, he will conduct the whole business in the manner of a provincial public function, with irrelevant speeches, effusive clapping, presentation of garlands, and a group photograph at the end of it all. Let us now trace the developments. 1974 was the year of the national railway strike and the Navnirman agitation in Gujarat, Indira Gandhi's direct appeal to populism seemingly bypassing the entire edifice of the state, which had come to be understood as something at this point, constituted precisely a dismantling of the common man as category before a differently situated, disciplined citizen subject. We know that around then, the Indian cinema, for example, did see this internal reform of middle-class cinema that seemingly existed in deference to the law of the state and its disciplining authority, the reformed citizen. And in fact, shortly before a view from the Tishoff had been done, Khakkar, very unlike himself, and Geeta talked about that this morning, had made two explicitly political paintings, Mukti Bahini Soldier and Factory Strike. And in both paintings, especially in Factory Strike, where an expressionless face of a member of the proletariat stares back at us, we have something that would in some way resist this viewer's conquest as sole interpretative authority, as something that demanded that we acknowledge the presence of an imaginary, something that provided serious impediments at that point to the viewer in his claim as representative of the state to appropriate reality into his representation of the symbolic. Now, if we put all of this baggage behind us, then I think now I can produce this new reading of a view from the Tishoff, which is a somewhat grim view. The view from the Tishoff and its evacuation of the logic of internal narration provides this picture of its time. The view now is indeed one that has been appropriated by the viewers of the painting in an art gallery, but it now constitutes little more than a remnant of what once was a thriving economy of the gaze. There is no designated viewer. There is literally no designated viewer, because barring the few people who are reduced to their role in both the political economy of the time, and this includes people like the builders and so on, and all the people who then had to talk less and work more, as well as a new economy of the gaze from which they literally possessed nothing that could protect themselves from being looked at, that viewer simply did not exist anymore. But that viewer was actually to reappear, and that's the really important thing. This particular painting, although I suppose Geeta might not have known this, and this might have been the last painting of Bhupen's that she saw when she completed her chapter, was the first of a series of paintings which we all know very well of views from the streets. And this particular viewer, this absent viewer, was to reappear as a naked man in a balcony who was the compulsive narrativizer, who this time round told a story about a street scene, took it out of its simultaneity, and enacted something outside of it. He took off his clothes and said, "You can't please all." The realist drive involves the deployment of the citizen as a figure of the narrative, and consequently a reform of the protocols of spectatorship. Melodrama, on the other hand, is a symptom of the restricted effectivity of the reconstitution of the social around the figure of the citizen, a sign that is under the overall dominance of contractual relations, there remains a zone of charismatic or more generally sub or extra contractual subject positions occupied by marginalized sectors. In short, those who were not signatories to the original fictive social contract. That is to say, people who were not named or not recognized by the creation of the citizen subject. I want to get into this question of melodrama and realism. Melodrama is, as I said, a secondarized version of realism, and it has certain benefits because it says it includes marginalized segments that were excluded by the construction of the realist citizen subject viewer, and therefore also, you know, introduces certain sort of seemingly traditional modes of address which are presented as preceding and in some ways incommensurable with realist reform. This renegotiation leads to certain key differences. By and large, unlike realism, which has to provide a form of speech, realism has to provide a form of speech that appears to be imminent to the represented scene, melodrama usually works with what can be called an already interpreted speech, whose chief virtue is that its meanings are readily visible on the surface, but whose biggest limitation is that it has to act out that speech in a public arena, cleansed of its interpersonal character, and in a manner that would assume its full elevation to the status of symbolic discourse. Now, all of these characteristics are in fact fully evident in the early Bhupenkakar and what Geeta Kapoor then called his kind of realism, the public nature of his art making, his willingness to see the work of art subsumed into a sector of petty commodification, the already interpreted nature of speech that he invokes, like instead of the French ambassador, etc., etc. And most of all, the nature of his protagonists, the jalebi eaters, the watch repairers, literally surrounded as though they were themselves religious icons by decorative renderings of objects of their daily use. I want to, with this, now return to the earlier question that I'd asked, which was that if there is a certain suppression or evacuation of a key narrative element of realist organization, then where does it go? Now, by asking another kind of question. That is, that if the responsibilities of an imminent speech, supposedly the responsibilities of realism, if the responsibilities of imminent speech are themselves suppressed by the illusion of an already interpreted speech, then what is it that now takes on those responsibilities and the anxieties of authoring that imminent speech modes? I think there are some really important clues that Bhupenkakar offers here. I want to argue that the free invocation in his work to introject his several protagonists, his jelly eaters and his common men, back into narrative function, as we, for example, start imagining the kind of lives they lead, the kinds of insecurities they live with, etc., that reintrojection occurs with the power it does for some very important reasons, because now the community is defined mainly as an externalized, socialized, already interpreted speech form, which exists only in its infinite ability to reproduce a certain kind of fully symbolic discourse endlessly into all that it encounters. This seemingly full discourse, which Bhupenkakar can, as it were, take as already interpreted, develops its power because it functions with what, in fact, Slavoj Žižek called a deceptive surface beneath which swarms an undergrowth of perverse and obscene implications, the domain of what is prohibited. And thus functions not in its overtly communitarian economy, but in a secondarized economy, what I might call a libidinal economy, that works only because it is framed by the contours of an already interpreted speech, supposedly the speech of melodrama. Now we can see the shift that takes place. The last painting that Bhupenkakar did that I know of that referred to this economy was Gallery of Rogues, a painting of a whole series of people which were like passport photographs or family photographs framed within the frame. And, you know, they were presented in this extremely conventional manner, leaving you free to imagine what these people were, or indeed whether they were in fact the common man in his new guise. It was the loss of this economy, this libidinal communitarian economy of already interpreted speech, with the advent of realist protocols in his painting here, that constitutes the site of the loss that we were trying to identify earlier. The melodramatic aspect of Kakkar had produced a secondarized terrain for acting out what we can only imagine beneath the cover and the reassurances of the symbolic order. With "you can't please all," that particular symbolic order coming to a threat, demanding not a descent into realism proper, but rather the need to read into reality a different kind of realism, which would locate once again in a changed context the original function of the symbolic order, Bhupenkakar saw it. Earlier, the factory strike painting, which I don't have, but which you maybe all remember, had this viewer at the looking at you and in some sense forcing you to acknowledge the presence of an imaginary. Has this painting in some way completely capitulated to this hypothetical real public, the tragedy of innocence, acknowledging this anonymous real public of the reformed spectator who is now in charge of this painting, whose view is supreme? Or are there things that in fact already suggest limitations, some things that resist? There are obviously two things in this painting which I have not referred to, which any realist reading would not refer to. One is that piece of cloth fluttering, and the other, in the far corner, that little painting within the painting, which I'm sure you can all see, which you can only understand in the light of Kakkar's subsequent work. I think it's important for you to sort of recognize that if there is a certain kind of loss of that organizational perspectival weight, and therefore the hierarchizing of knowledge, then that piece of cloth actually refuses to take on the transferred responsibility of reorganizing that space. And this is something that I'm sure, you know, many people here would be much more competent than me to talk about, of how, let's say, the weight of painting itself, the gesture, the mark, or the surface, actually takes on new burdens of something that is lost in realism. You know, as that question of where does it go becomes, you know, re-articulated again and again. Let me suggest to you that actually in certain ways, I'm almost through. Let me suggest, and I'm playing around here with art history. Let me suggest this particular cloth, in the fact that there's nothing that it has that allows you to appropriate it within that particular realist view I was trying to refer to, that it plays a role sort of similar to the sort of unnamed object at the bottom of Holbein's The Ambassadors, and I'm talking especially of Jacques Lacan's reading of that particular painting and that sort of phallic skull-like thing at the bottom of that particular painting, which Slavoj Žižek talks about using Lacan as a stain or a blot, you know, a meaningless stain. And I'd like you to look at this painting when I referred to Žižek talking about Lacan talking about a very different painting, a meaningless stain that denatures the work, rendering all its constituents suspicious, and thus opens up the abyss of the search for a meaning. Nothing is what it seems to be. Everything is to be interpreted. Everything is supposed to possess some supplementary meaning. The ground of the established familiar signification opens up. We find ourselves in a realm of total ambiguity, but this very lack propels us to produce ever new hidden meanings. It is a driving force of endless compulsion. The oscillation between lack and surplus meaning constitutes the proper dimension of subjectivity. In other words, it is by means of the, and here he actually makes the definition, this particular stain or spot, which he would call the phallic spot, that the unobserved, that the observed picture is subjectivized. This paradoxical point, and there could be other things, the use of color and so on, but I'm referring especially to these two things. This paradoxical point undermines our position as neutral, objective observers, pinning us to the observed object itself. This is the point at which the observer is already included, inscribed into the observed scene. In a way, it is the point from which the picture itself looks back at us. My third and final reading, therefore, which I can't take very far, but you know, which one sense of continues, is one that would actually sort of now try and map a certain sort of notion of the personal, a certain kind of individual struggle that Pupin himself was going through, and his mobilization of a communitarian discourse as opposed to the state, with a larger kind of political history, which I think this can be mapped on. To suggest that Kakar's work can best be read by overlapping the internal trajectory of an always symbolized enactment in the public arena with the recent political history of realism as state and post-regulation. In this sense, now, the first view, that is the diegetic view of an internal common man audience, viewer in the painting, would constitute something like a relay between the observed, obscene, perverse underside of what is prohibited by the domain of already interpreted communitarian speech with the secondarized process of making the painting and putting it into the public terrain of social acceptance. I think that many of the critics who write about Bhupen Kakar's work make the mistake of only referring to the second half of this process and not the first half. In this sense, I think that the particular first view, the internal diegetic view, could be seen as being something like just little more than a first stage, a sort of zero degree orchestration of an event and its devouring by its audience. The somewhat bland dimension, which is the dimension invoked by the middle class economy of, say, the hanging of a painting, you know, or more precisely, I suppose, its reproduction by Lalit Kala Academy, is one that Žižek, for example, says only whets our appetite as voyeurs. We remain captive of the illusion that we witness a homogeneous continuity of action, even as the dialectic of seen and unseen, of the field and its outside, give rise to the desire to see what is not shown. If that is so, then quite literally the second view of us looking at the painting, of us simulating the idealized citizen subject, of us, literally those of us in this room, trying to live up to the new responsibilities that the view expects us to shoulder, constitutes a second stage of simultaneity of action, where you know, I mean, Zizek talks about parallel montage, but we can see the connection of several interconnected courses of action that are, as it were, frozen into a kind of horizontal coexistence that force us as viewers to unfreeze, and sometimes quite frenetically to unfreeze the action, to invent psychological narratives that would take responsibility for our gaze and for the designations, the new designations that are given to our gaze. If that is so, then the third, or the redoubling that a view from the street, the view from the tea shop can now be seen to do with its two objects that do not fit, objects that in their sheer meaninglessness force an element of subjectivity far more effective than, say, the expressionless face of the man in factory strike, would be finally the true chronicle of the organizing logic within the painting and what happened to it. You know, where did it disappear? One last quotation. What has this inversion to do with the phallic stage? Phallic is precisely the detail that does not fit, that sticks out from the idyllic surface scene and denatures it, renders it uncanny. Would this be the final act then of abandoning the terrain of communitarian culture itself? I mean, would this have been the point at which Bhupenkaker actually abandoned the community as he knew it, as melodrama makes its compromises with realism? Perhaps the true question today would be once again that if this space of the symbolic has itself been withdrawn, then what does it replace itself with? I talked about realism and the contemporary earlier, and this, I suggest today, is the problem posed before those of us who would wish to define or redefine the contemporary in this postmodern age. Thank you.